You are listening to the annual NCRA Homelessness Marathon on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples in Vancouver.
Last Friday, CITR's Madeline Taylor went to the Downtown Eastside Women's Center to talk to a few women there about their experiences with homelessness or near homelessness here in Vancouver. In this interview, Sheena talks about precarious housing, being stuck in an abusive relationship, and her passion for writing.
My brother kicked me out just before graduation because there was hair on the floor in the washroom. I was missing school. My grades were falling behind, but I'd just gotten them back up and I was about to be able to graduate from a regular, from New Westminster Secondary School. Yeah, it was like, because my hair is really thick and I'd leave stuff on the floor and I didn't notice when I was brushing my hair, but I was always cleaning up and it was almost as if his foster parent had some stashed and was one day they were like, oh, no, there's still hair on the floor. You got to go. I went back to my mom's and she did the same thing because we were getting evicted from her place. So she said, I'm moving downtown. And basically, she didn't even say that. She just kind of let us figure out that we weren't going into a new place with her. I got extremely angry and was just completely betrayed. I threw stuff on the floor and was just like, whatever, packed up everything. Don't remember exactly how, ended up having to move in with somebody 20 years older than me who I found out later is probably a sociopath. Yeah, I found a job right away at Wendy's and then completed my grade 12 through distance online, and stayed with this person who basically wore down the rest of my sense of, most of this left like maybe a kernel of my sense of self, which I just escaped from last year. I was trying to leave from the beginning, but kind of just found myself sort of stuck because of the trauma bond that was created very early on. Mm-hmm. After I moved in with this person, I had gotten my own place when I was 23, but ended up moving back in with the person and left again, but kept in contact with this person because I just felt like he was the only one who I ever had to help me. I haven't actually stayed in a shelter and I haven't actually stayed on the street, but I've been kind of on the verge of homelessness since 17 in the last three places that I've had. I just feel like I've been discriminated against and I'm actually dealing with a bogus eviction right now. It just seems like it doesn't end. So I was given an eviction notice because I didn't let them in that day, but they were supposed to give me 4 days anyways. So yeah, even though I have been somewhere for the past year, it's really kind of what they call house poor. I have enough for rent, but the rest of my time is spent getting food and the other essentials. Maybe others should come down and rub shoulders with the same people that they're supposedly trying to help, because that's the only way to get an idea of what we're actually going through. I feel like they're so far removed from the real people's stories and lives. I mean, we don't want the $2 for drugs. We want to be a normal person and be able to go get a coffee once in a while, or go get a little bit of food, or something like Band-Aids or something, you know, like that can go a long way for a person. Half the time, we're invisible. And if we're not invisible, we're getting a dirty look for not looking like the rest of society. Another thing I've noticed is that it's really, really tough for homeless men. They're really on their own. And I think it has something to do with the fact that they're supposed to be able to take care of themselves. Nobody's in that situation for the fun of it. Something terrible's happened, and they can't just pull up their boots and take care of themselves. There's not really as many of the, even though I'm just getting by because there's a few resources for women, there's nothing for homeless men, and they really, really get overlooked. So they have a huge place in my heart. My passion is writing and creating, and I want to go back to school for desktop publishing. I like to write about what I've been through. I do short poems about the parasitic relationship that I was in. I feel like certain segments of the population are very vulnerable to being subjugated and manipulated by people who can see that there's some sort of trauma in their past. And I actually want to start a blog about that, just to kind of let girls know when you're in a relationship with a bad person. Because the consequences can be long-lasting.
That interview was conducted by Madeline Taylor. Huge thanks to the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and to Sheena for sharing her experiences. Katrina tells us about coming from an abusive home and dealing with society's expectations.
I'm Katrina, like the hurricane that started in New Orleans. Essentially, I'm a big, scary Marmo Lamia-type creature. The person that raised me obviously had Munchausen, Munchausen by proxy, because most of the decisions she'd made, when other people would go over them, they'd usually be like, why is she doing that? Later, as an adult, I'm starting to realize how risky her behavior was. And at the same time, there's all kinds of situations that I was put into that the other kids weren't put into that would get me injured. And I, as a kid, I didn't know what was going on, so I just thought, I guess I'm just not as good as the other kids, and I need to work on being as good as the other kids. She wanted to get the attention of having a sick child. You have to progress with those stages sort of things because you stop getting attention. Oh, your kids have a sprained ankle again. Oh, okay, good. Cry me a river. Oh, your kids are... Eventually, it led to me being homeless and her talking to people. Oh, my eldest is homeless on drugs, whoring herself out. I got kicked out when I was 15. I mean, I still interacted with the person who gave me birth, but what happened was I fought back for the first time. I'm shelter hopping. I'm trying to, like, you know, only spend certain amounts of time at certain shelters or whatnot, and trying to schedule it. I'm not very good at it yet. Spends a lot of times where I'm just staying awake all night or whatnot, you know, just somewhere. I keep getting, like, you know, SRO housing for short periods of time, and then bullshit happens. You're probably going to have to, like, you know, bleep that out or whatnot, but... The thing with being homeless and on off the streets is everybody's all like, you're not doing enough to get off. You should just do more. Why aren't you doing more? And it's to the point where I do the impossible quite regularly.
So what are your hopes for the future? Like, what do you hope changes?
I kind of want to take over the entire solar system. People, when they say, what are your dreams? They have a very limited set of things that are actually possible dreams, because... When people are like, well, if you tone it down a little bit, and then my immediately follow-up is all, I'd like to have a sandwich sometime this afternoon. A nice, decent sandwich. people's immediate response, well, no, we need something in between there. And it just sounds like people have this set list of things that are like okay goals, and I've never actually seen this list. And what you can do in society before, like, it won't even necessarily be illegal stuff, and yet you'd still be, like, you know, getting kicked out of places, moved around or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And everything you're doing is still, it's not even technically legal, it is legal, but because it's not on that set small list of okay goals, it's going to mess up your life. Mm-hmm. There's limited things for what's okay to be in this world. And this is starting to sound like heavy conspiracy theorist type thing, and no, I'm not wearing tinfoil hat. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't ground those only, like, you know, make the single signal stronger. that's a joke.
This interview was conducted by Madeline Taylor. Big thank yous to the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and to Katrina for sharing her experiences.
Sheree Sutran, and you're listening to the NCRA Homelessness Marathon on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Megaphone Magazine offices in the downtown east side. We are broadcasting from the traditional ancestral unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people in Vancouver. For podcasts, full-length interviews, and more information, visit CITR.ca. I am here with my co-host, Eva Ugren-Senge, and she will be explaining more about why we're here tonight.
Hi, this is Eva. So we're here to talk about the annual Homelessness Marathon. The yearly overnight broadcast is shared on campus and community stations from coast to coast across Canada. And the marathon began in 1998 in Geneva, New York. This year, the marathon is broadcasting from Abbotsford CIVL station at 101.7 FM. The concept moved north to Canada 13 years ago with CCUT FM in Montreal as the host station, and it was hosted by McGill University for 11 years. This is the first time that it's been coordinated by a British Columbia station. We're broadcasting from Megaphone Magazine, which is an organization that has more than 40 vendors selling the magazine. Many of the vendors struggle with various barriers, homelessness, addiction, or a mental illness. And selling the paper gives the vendors a voice in their community and raises their self-esteem. So we have one of those vendors with us here today. His name is Chris Gronk, and he'll be speaking with me right now. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you tonight?
Good. So why did you decide to come down here and talk to us about Megaphone?
Because being homeless made my life the happiest it's ever been, and I just wanted to come down and share that.
So, why'd you say that? Why would you say like homelessness made you the happiest you've ever been? What do you want to explain to people?
Well, 7 years ago, I had a couple of surgeries on my spine, and my family had dissolved. Everything had gone bad, and I was panhandling down in front of a Tim Hortons, and I'd given up everything, given up every reason to live. I didn't care, and. So I went up and I started to panhandle there because I knew if I went down to the east side that it would be easy for me to survive down there. It would be a lot harder to survive around the civilians, as I used to put it, you know, the normal people who went to work every day. It would be a lot harder for me to get along up there. And I didn't want happiness, I thought. Because I could have survived on the east side. And a woman come by one day and told me that things were going to be good. And one day that I would get up off the ground, because I was sitting on the sidewalk, and she could see it in my face. And that day changed my life. And if I hadn't have been sitting at that chair at that time, being homeless, down and out, ready to die, I wouldn't be so happy and secure and blessed as I am today.
And when she said that to you, where did you go from there?
Well, you know, and she would always come by and buy me a coffee and encourage me on her way to work, because I would always sit at the same spot. And I began to think to myself, you know, I need to act on this, you know, and to prove something to her. I wanted to make her right. Let her know she was right. And so I picked up and started to sell the Megaphone paper on the corner. Mm-hmm. And my life started to get better
and
for a while.
What did it mean for you to sell the magazine? What was important about that?
I had somewhere to go every day. I treated it like a job. I invested my little bit of money I had. I would invest in the paper, and I had a job. I had somewhere to go, and I felt welcome up there. And I mean, it took a little bit of time, a little bit of perseverance, but eventually I felt welcome and just at home selling the paper, and my personality began to shine.
Was there difficulties in selling the paper? Is it hard to get started?
Well, you do a lot of stuff under your breath, and you just got to be patient and smiley and humble. You got to humble yourself and understand, you know, the civilians of the world, and try to understand their outlook on life and how they look at me as they're walking down the street.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memorable experiences of people that you met that way?
Well, the job I have today, I met him through Megaphone. I mean, he walked past me for 2 years without ever saying a word to me. And then one day at Christmas, he come and he bought the paper off me with a bag full of change. And then he would come by and talk to me every day and give me a $20 bill for the paper, and he just kept coming by. And for 2 years, he didn't say a word. And then one day he looked at me and he said, "Hey, I'm practically giving you a paycheck now. You might as well come work in my shop." And he's a reputable goldsmith here in town, and I'm learning about gold and stuff. And
mm-hmm. So a big part of doing this broadcast is to raise awareness about homelessness and talk about the stigmas surrounding it. What's something that you think is important for people to know about what being homeless is like? What's something that people get wrong?
That we're all drug addicts, that we're all manipulative, we're all looking for a freebie, we're all looking for a way in without paying the toll.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not all like that. We're not all chasing the dragon. You know, some of us are chasing a glass of milk for our craft dinner. You know, some of us are looking for, you know, a half-decent burger instead of, you know, soup-lined soup, you know. You go to a place where they serve soup for breakfast, and as you're leaving, you can see all the spots where the soup ended up, if you understand what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, people need the real food. People need that butter for their craft dinner. You ever had craft dinner without margarine, you know? And then we're not all down there, you know. We need money. Mm-hmm. We need a couple of dollars, nutrition-wise.
You were talking before about how you came down to the downtown east side because you knew you could survive there. What is it about the downtown? Did you find a sense of community here? Or what was it about that helped you survive?
Well, on the east side, it would have been too easy for me. I mean, everything is easy down there. I mean, you don't have to work for nothing. Everything is brought to you. Everything is delivered to you on a platter. I mean, there's so many outreach workers. There's so many cars pulling over. I mean, down there, you can survive on nothing. You don't need anything. I went up and started panhandling because I didn't know how to deal with that kind of person. And I thought it would be harder for me in my life. I might come to different choices if I had to live in that atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do you still face some of that stigma now, or do you talk to people about being homeless before?
Oh, I through selling Megaphone and stuff, I got to know some professors at BCIT and language instructors and stuff like that. And I eventually there was a lot of turmoil between students and panhandlers in the neighborhood around Dunsmuir and Seymour. And so I had a handbook, and I wanted to ease the tension. So an instructor lady I knew helped me start a class, and I was able to, I called it Street Smarts 101, and I was able to talk to the language kids about panhandlers and about me and how I started and where I am today. And it eased tensions on the corner. You know, after that, it was more, hi, Chris. They'd come by, and it was a lot. Tensions were eased so much in those few classes that I taught. And
what was it like teaching a class, being a teacher?
It was good. I mean, there were language students, and there was a little bit of a difficulty, but afterwards, like I say, when I'd be back out there selling the megaphone, that's when I realized that they did get something out of it. They changed the way they looked at me and the way they would look at other panhandlers and just street people in general. Mm-hmm.
Is that something you're still doing, or is that over now?
Oh, no, the class, I stopped doing that about a year ago. Mm-hmm.
So now you've got a job with this Goldsmith. Do you have any plans, or are you happy with kind of where you're at right now?
Oh, I'm shooting for the stars now. I'm going to have a few molds made up this year. I'm going to start selling a bit of jewelry. I hope to learn more about casting jewelry. I want to eventually know it all and learn it all and make some jewelry.
And looking back, how important was megaphone in making that happen?
I wouldn't be who I am. I wouldn't be alive if it weren't for megaphone. I would have died in that alley a long time ago from some kind of overabundance of myself.
All right. Well, thanks very much for talking with us, Chris.
No, thank you.
Thanks to Eva and Chris. And next up, we have an interview from folks from the Downtown Eastside Women's Center.
Center. We talk about her experience of being homeless, her feelings about homelessness, and how the Women's Center helped her get back on her feet.
It was 9 years ago, and I was actually living out in Coquitlam, and I was working out there. I was in a basement suite at the time, and I would have stayed there for the rest of my life, I think, but situations happen, you know, when you rent. The lady who owned the house, her son, she was moving back to Italy, getting remarried, and her son didn't want to go, and he wanted my suite. So I was out the door, and I managed to find another one to rent with another lady in the same area. And her and her son were on the BC housing list to get into a place. So when they got in, the rent was too expensive for me, so I found myself out the door again, and I thought, I can't keep doing this. I can't. And that's when I decided to put all my stuff into storage. And the only person I knew on this planet was my brother who lived down here. So that's where I stayed on his couch in his little apartment for 3 months while I went out job hunting and stuff until I was lucky enough to get into Bruce Harris and he knew what my situation was. They call it neighborhood housing. I hadn't lived in Vancouver since the 70s. I knew nothing about the homeless situation. I walked through the Women's Center doors and I was in chronic pain. I had nowhere to live and I had no job. I had my stuff in storage, and I had, in my head, given myself 3 months, which I'd saved money for from a job I'd had previously, to keep my stuff in storage until I got into a place. So I was, quite truthfully, I guess it was a basket case, and people in retrospect said, yeah, you were a basket case. And I was really just on the brink of giving up, mm-hmm. quite honestly. I was very lucky in retrospect, and I realized it not far down the line, that I was lucky to have bypassed the whole shelter episode. When I was homeless and living, I had packed a suitcase up and put enough clothes in there. I thought, I've got change of clothing here, I've got something I can wear if I'm going to look for a job and whatever. And so I was basically living out of my suitcase for 3 months while I was living on my brother's couch. Until I cried and they crashed and I was directed to the Women's Center. And from that point, I got into Bruce Erickson, where I've been for 9 years. And I was just so thankful. I thought, oh my God, never again would I put myself in that kind of position. You know, you seriously can't see yourself clearly when you're in pain of any kind like that, whether it's physical, mental. I put tentacles out into the neighborhood and I became a volunteer here at the center, and I've been a volunteer for 9 years. I know that housing is a crunch, mm-hmm. and especially if you're on limited income and such. I have some disabilities of my own, which makes it difficult for me some days to work well. That affects my ability to concentrate a lot. I came from having a home on the island and a car and a family and all this to being a single parent and having nowhere to live. And you know, as I say, over time, it's like that chronic pain, you know, over time, you just don't want to feel it anymore. You know, you want it to go away, or you want something to help alleviate that pain. And it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. You know, I came from a middle class sort of upper, you know, home situation to being homeless. I think a lot of people down here have had losses over time, whether it's people in their lives or material or, you got to go to the root of something to find out what's causing the pain or whatever it is. You know what I mean? It's like a doctor who knows where and how to look and, you know, to find exactly what the problem is. And I think that's what they need with the homeless situation. You know, I've talked with people who've, you know, been in a situation. I understand some of the problems that go along with it because I've had them. The trouble is that over time that it starts to wear you down. I get why people turn to drugs and turn to all these things. They're trying to cope, you know, whether it's with pain, whether it's with a situation that's happened in their past or whatever it is. We're all here because we had backgrounds that were screwed up on us somehow. You know, you seriously can't see yourself clearly when you're in pain of any kind like that, whether it's physical, mental. It's making me a bit upset and I didn't realize it was going to. But, you know, it's still... You know, it's not an easy subject and it's not an easy thing to go through. And the people who can do it are survivors. The Women's Center was a blessing, and I still thank, you know, whoever to have guided me here and told me here to go here, and I always feel safe in this space.
You just heard an interview by me, Madeline Taylor, with an anonymous volunteer at the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. A huge thanks to the Downtown Eastside Women's Center and the women who shared their stories with me. You are listening to the annual NCRA Homelessness Marathon on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples in Vancouver.
Hi, I'm Sheree Sutran, and you're listening to the NCRA Homelessness Marathon on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Megaphone Magazine offices in the Downtown East Side. Right now, you've been listening to Pete Thompson, who's going to be reading his piece called Past and Present, which was written in 2012 for the Voices of the Street literary issue of Megaphone Magazine.
Hello, past and present. If you take from the earth, you give back to it. And what do you take, you make use of. I grew up in a small community in Fraser Canyon called Boston Bar. People say, don't blink your eyes or you'll miss it. So I headed to Vancouver in the 70s to look for work and some different scenery and got a job at a loggers agency. They sent me out to camp where I worked 30 days on, 10 days off. Work was hard there. They fed you good, the pay was good, and it's very dangerous. One guy had a log roll over him. He stood up and tried to say something, but he just collapsed. The log crushed his chest, and just like that, he was gone. Then machinery started taking over the laborers, and I was in search of other employment where I grew up. Our traditional ways taught me it was always important to give back to the earth what do you take from it. I saw that they needed tree planters, and I thought it was a good way for me to give back to the land. I worked for a year at that job, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, planting many, many trees. I also wanted to make use of what I took out of the land, so I enrolled in the carpentry at Caribou College. Then worked in Kamloops for 2 years, but again, small town work was short, so again I found myself in Vancouver, where I worked as a carpenter for 25 years. I helped build many apartments and residential houses, but it could also be dangerous. One day on a job, I was carrying a big I-beam and stepped in a pothole I didn't see. I tripped and my leg went snap, crackle, pop, and my shin bone was sticking out. In all, I got 5 pins in my ankle, 1 in my shin, bolts in my knees, and 1 in my femur. I couldn't work anymore. When you become used to working hard and good money coming in, and then find yourself unemployed, depression sets in. So I started drinking. From there, I went from single room occupancy hotel rooms to the streets. I drank every day with a group of friends that came. That can take a toll on you. One day I realized it wasn't only hurting me, but my family too. I wanted to quit. I told my friends I was going to quit, and they gave me their full support. Instead of trying to push a bottle on me, they gave me words of encouragement. "Right on, bro," they said, "keep it up." That's what kept me reaching for my goal. These are true friends. Now I find myself on a different path, healthy, happy, focused, and more energetic. I've been through a lot. Sometimes I didn't know if I was going to make it. But through words of wisdom, the elders taught me the greatest gift is giving. It's something I'll always remember. I like giving back to my family, friends, and my community. May it be through writing, volunteering, selling megaphone, and hoping shadows, or just helping the guy on the street. Now I have a purpose, and it's a great feeling to know I'm doing something for myself and others.
So that was Chris, that was Pete Thompson reading his story called Past and Present for Voices on the Street. And so do you mind if we ask you a few questions? So what exactly inspired that piece that you just read?
Well, this piece, I wanted to read it because it'll get out to a lot of people outside of downtown East Side, and they know what we're all about and how people got down there instead of just what the media portrays people as, drug addicts or alcoholics, but that people are struggling and striving for their life to be better, not what the media always portrays them.
So then why did you decide to come here today to tell that story?
Well, I want to help out so that other people will know what we are about too, and that what homelessness is and what people do to thrive, to try to better themselves instead of other people saying what they think and what people have to know what we're really about.
So do you think that most people are more like you and not really conforming to the stereotypes that we normally have of homeless people?
Well, there's a lot of people that have their own ways of thinking about people, and some of them like to push people away just because they're homeless, and that's not right, because people should be helping instead of pushing people away. Like, even our government should be doing more to helping people instead of just going out there and saying they're doing this and they're doing that, but they're doing some, but they're still taking more away. Like, they'll put something into this, then they'll do something else to take it right back, which isn't right. Like what they're doing with the people with the disabilities, right?
So what's like one thing that you would want some people to know when they see a homeless person on the street?
Well, I want them to know that these people are there, and they're not there just for a reason, but they're there because they want help, not only from just the people themselves, but they want people to know who that they really are, and to give them that extra pride or lift up in themselves so that they could help themselves too.
So how did you first get involved with Megaphone?
Megaphone, I got involved with Megaphone through Hope and Shadows. I was selling Hope and Shadows, and they asked me if I wanted to sell the paper.
How did you get involved with Hope and Shadows in the first place?
Oh, that was years ago. I was walking by downtown Eastside, and I seen this big lineup. And I stopped and asked them what the lineup was for, and they said, cameras. They said, get a camera, you could take a picture. First prize is $500. And I just kept going. I said, no, I said, I wouldn't win anyway. But then I turned around, I got a camera, and that first year I got honorary prize, which helped me and kept me going with the picture taking, and it made the calendars more easier to sell too if you got a picture in the calendar.
So what was the picture of?
It was my sister's dog and cat in an armchair.
So I guess, so you started selling that magazine at that point in time. How did the photo project sort of change what was going on in your life at that point in time?
Well, getting a picture in gave you a big boost because it gave you some self-esteem that you could do something other than than just sitting around, or it gave you something that you could always look forward to, and I've been taking pictures. I've got one on the front cover, which was good 1 year. That was in 2011. And the year before this, I got four that made the top 40, and two made the calendar.
And so when did you start writing for Megaphone and doing that kind of expression?
Oh, it must have been around 2011 I started writing for Megaphone street papers, and the Voices of the Street I started writing in 2012. And there's going to be another book coming out at the end of April. I'm working on a story for that now too. So
what's the story about?
It's about, they gave a subject called change. So you could write out anything about change, anything that comes to mind.
So what was your particular story that you wrote about a change?
Mine's going to be about nature, natural changes in nature, like how a cocoon turns into a butterfly, spreads its wings and flies, to even a tadpole swimming in the water, to becoming a frog and living on the land. Sort of changes of all nature that gives us, like it's a natural thing, and it's natural that we should go back to the nature where things were right then, because then this world wouldn't be the mess it's in, right?
Very cool. I guess we'll have to buy the issue out in April to find out more. Just to wrap up, so how do you feel like the photo project and Megaphone has changed people's reactions to homeless people?
A lot of people think that it's a good thing, because a lot of people, like, they support the project itself because they know it's helping somebody. And by buying the Hope and Shadows calendar, they buy it every year after year, and they even buy it for gifts for people. So it gives them a purpose to go out and help somebody, and then they spread the word, somebody else helps somebody else too. It just gives them that feeling that they know that the people from the Megaphone street paper or the Hope and Shadows calendar are out there trying to do something for themselves.
So purpose is big.
Yeah, That's true.
Okay. And so that was Pete Thompson. And so we're going to go to another interview with folks from the Downtown Eastside Women's Center.
This is an interview by me, Madeline Taylor, with Victoria, who I met at the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. Victoria is a proud mom of 5 kids and a proud grandmother of 12 kids. She has lived in the Downtown Eastside for 18 years. She lives with addictions and has lived with homelessness. These are her words.
Hi, my name is Victoria Sumner Majeski Palche Token Spence. That's it. I'm a grandmother of 5 kids and 12 grandchildren, who I'm very proud of. My children are doing well. My son is working. My daughter's working. My daughter-in-law is working. My daughter's in the process. She wants to work, but she's looking after a baby right now. It's hard to make it because you don't have a job. Some people who are on welfare don't have a job, don't know how to get a job, have never experienced having a job. And then there's those like myself who've had a job. I've had a job as a bus driver, paramedic, been married, had a house. People have died on me, various people close to me, and some to my family and friends, and it's difficult. And homelessness is a crime, I believe, because I walked down the street, I was homeless for 3 years. I looked for places, I went to various landlords, they said, we don't have anything, we're full. So I'm a woman alone in the world, and I thought, oh, this is great, I'm a grandma, my kids are... And you've got all kinds of things running through your mind, like, my God, what do they think of me? I'm a grandma. And for my kids, sometimes my kids are kind of like, well, Mom, I don't get it, you know, like, I tried this, I tried that, I just can't do it. And kind of like, I know you're struggling, honey, you know, and you try to make the best out of what you have, and sometimes it's not a lot. And I mean, like, I'm not homeless now. I haven't been homeless for 8 years. Mm-hmm. I've been living in Vancouver 18 years. I'm not from this province, but I've been volunteering here for 18 years. Now I'm looking at getting a real job. What led me to be homeless for 3 years was, I don't really know, I can't remember that far back. I haven't been homeless for quite a while now, but I remember I just couldn't afford it, basically. Mm-hmm. That's why I was homeless. Bottle picking to survive, I did that too, bottle pick for 3 years. Me and my spouse, we slept in a park. One of the issues was that my spouse was homeless too, and I was homeless, but we never left each other alone. It was scary sometimes. I mean, you're sleeping in the middle of the night, you don't know who's coming at you, or what dangers you're in, or how safe you're feeling. You know, and it's not always possible to get a tent when you're homeless because the prices, and what you can put in a tent, how warm it is, the weather conditions. For my children, my son is very hardworking. He has a baby. His wife has a good job at UGM, and he's going to be a carpenter. He's born October 13th, 1989. I'm very proud of him and his wife. And my daughter, who was born 1988, April 28th. My other daughter, June 22nd, 1983. And I have 2 children in Manitoba who are older, Michelle and Billy Joel. Cyrus, and it hurts. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've gone home sometimes, I'm in tears. And then, yeah, sometimes my addiction becomes an issue because I'm so tired. I'm like, I just need to party. I can't take it. Mm-hmm. I'm partying, that's it. You know, so with a lot of people in their addictions, they tend to feel that way too, because I live with a lot of it. I have a lot of addict friends. I'm being an addict myself. I'm a crack user. Mm-hmm. At one time I was an alcoholic, but I haven't drank for 18 years. I used to be a needle user of 13 years. I haven't done needles for 18 years. And now I'm a crack addict, and I just have to give that up, and I'm doing it. You know, I'm not perfect, but nobody can be expected to be perfect, but come off it, you know, like, what role are you playing with us if you don't, you know, meet us halfway? Mm-hmm. I've been volunteering here for 18 years, mm-hmm. and I feel safe here, and I feel that I can put something on my resume when I want to go get a real job, which will be in the future, I'm hoping. Mm-hmm. I have 20 good years of my life left. Mm-hmm. So that's a start. You know, I don't want to wait till I have nothing left. I work at two different centers. I work for the Wish Center and I work for the Downtown Eastside Women's Center longer. But I respect the staff here at both places. And yeah, there's days it's hard here, you know, not everybody's listening or paying attention to each other, but you know, we have to get on, but you know. But I just want to let people know that sometimes when the shoe's on the other foot, you got to try a pair on and walk in their moccasins like you'd walk in your own.
You just heard an interview with Victoria, who I met at the Downtown Eastside Women's Center. Victoria has been a volunteer at the Women's Center for 18 years and has struggled with homelessness.
I know I'll give it all one day, baby, like I know a good man should.
Hello, you are listening to the NCRA Homelessness Marathon on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the Megaphone Magazine offices in the downtown east side. I'm Madeline Taylor. I'm here with a whole bunch of folks from CITR and a whole bunch of folks from Megaphone. And we're broadcasting from the traditional ancestral unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish people here in Vancouver. So the song you just heard was B.B. King, The Thrill Is Gone, and that was a request from Chris Kronk, who is one of the people we've been interviewing today, and we've got some more of that with Lucy Clarkson. So
hi there, everybody. My name is Lucy Clarkson. I'm the CITR Student Programming Coordinator at UBC, and I'm here back with Chris Kronk because we want to hear a little bit more about some of your stories here. We heard a little bit of an overview of your experiences with Megaphone, but I think you were mentioning how there's so much more to your story here. You said over the past 7 years you've had quite an experience. A lot has changed, and so you started off selling Megaphone, but you had to take a bit of a break. Can you tell me a little bit more about what's going on there?
Yeah. I began selling Megaphone, and my life was improving. I was coming off of my painkillers after my surgeries. I mean, I was still doing a little bit of drugs, but my life was getting together slowly. And then when I think everything was okay, I come home one day and I get a letter telling me that my kids were put into foster care. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I being in the shape I was in, I didn't know how I could help. I didn't know what I was going to do. My life was just getting better. I didn't want to change anything, but I couldn't turn my back. And so I tucked my tail and I jumped on the ferry and I went to see what I could do, knowing the shape I was in was not going to be impressive. And I spent a year there and with a lot of tough road to walk while I was there. And finally the kids got back with their mom and I came back to Vancouver. But while I was there, the social workers made me realize how their view of me wasn't favorable. And when I was coming back, I realized that I needed the world to look at me differently. And when my kids got older, I wanted them to have a version of me that wasn't what the social worker or their mother was going to tell them how I was looking when I first got there. So when I come back, I knew I needed to change the way. I didn't know how I was going to do it, but the world needed to look at me differently. And I think that one going over there, as scared as I was the only selfless act I ever committed in my whole life. Everything I'd ever done was a selfish thing. It was always for me. And doing that was the very first selfless thing I'd ever done. And I come back, I didn't know how I was going to change it. And I started to sell Megaphone again. And with encouragement from Sean and the people here at the paper, I began to write. I began to get involved a little bit more with the paper, getting my voice out. And the people in downtown Vancouver, Sean told me it was going to be hard to make any money down there. They're tough people to have to deal with. And I was so shocked that they, after a very short time, they welcomed me in. And when I started to write and express myself, and they just supported me throughout my time down there. Anything I wanted to do, they supported me. I wanted to do a class. I was selling my paper one day, and the language schools take kids around, do little tours. And I hear the tour guide tell them, you know, don't talk to panhandlers. They're all drug addicts. They all get enough money from the government. You know, don't talk to them. And I was offended, and I told him that. And I knew an instructor lady, and I said, you know, something's got to give here. You know, this ain't right. And so I was able to teach a class and talk to the kids about what it was to be a panhandler and how things were different. And everything I wanted to do, I just mentioned a blog one day, you know, and I told the instructor at BCIT, you know, if a dog can have a blog, so can I. 2 days later, he had my blog set up for me, you know, and so I began, you know, lucidcity.ca was my blog. And they were just there to support me all the way, and I couldn't believe it. And after a year or two, things started to get even better. And people were just there for me, and you always hear how people are cold and they're on their way to work and they're just cold people, but they take the time. If you put in the time, that they'll take the time. They're curious. They want to know what's going on, and I think the media and everybody tries to keep us apart. You know, they want the normal people to think that all the panhandlers are this way, and they want the panhandlers to think everybody up there is that way, and to separate us. We need to get together. You know, we need to get together and see the value that's in all of us. I mean, I met some people down there, very, very well-to-do people who I've learned some stuff, and that makes me realize they're just like me, because they make dumber mistakes than I have, you know, and just getting a camaraderie and first name, and I began to feel like human, like I was human again, and that I could change the way the world looked at me. And then one day one of my customers came up to me and offered me a job. So I took it, and shortly after, Bill comes to me and he says, you know, I recommended you for this job. And right at that point is when I realized that I had changed the way the world was looking at me. Bill recommended me for this job at a goldsmith's. I mean, they got to be looking at me different than I ever looked at myself before. And I realized it was happening, and taking and realizing what was going on in my life helped me continue to grow and to be here with you guys.
And it's incredible to hear that you gave yourself an opportunity to like ask for help, or not even help, but just ask, just put it out there in the open, and people gave you an opportunity to make that happen. And so you were talking a little bit about how people saw you, and how did you feel that your feelings towards other people changed?
Well, just like I say, I always thought that they were the civilians. They didn't know what it was to live a hard life. You know, they were the cattle that went back and forth to work. And I never realized the same as, you know, I used to tell them all the time, you know, as a panhandler, there's a little boy out there who thinks of me as Uncle Chris and remembers me as Uncle Chris and all the great things when I used to take him skating. And if you saw me today sitting here panhandling, he would still feel the same way. That's Uncle Chris. And I want everybody to know that's Uncle Joe over there, aunts, you know, somebody's little niece, you know, is always going to love him, and that we're people. And just to realize there are people out there that care about us, and we're worthwhile.
Absolutely. And remove this us and them and separation.
That's right.
Of that circumstance. Absolutely. And you were mentioning too before that you do quite a bit of writing now since being involved with Megaphone. So what's your experience been around that?
Well, I think I've had about 8 or 9 different things published. I've spoken at the Writers Festival a couple years in a row. I've done a few workshops. Café du Soleil, I did a reading there. And yeah, I just write.
And you mentioned your first piece was in Megaphone as well. What was that all about?
Well, the first piece that I wrote for Megaphone was a poem that I had written in the year 2000. And I'd never written anything before in my life. And I was in prison at the time, and I was going through a language barrier. And the year 2000 was coming upon, and they had a contest. What the year 2000 means to you. And you could write something, paint a picture, whatever you wanted. And 98% of the population didn't really speak much English. And so I said to myself, you know, I'm going to write a poem, and I'm going to show these people. And I wrote it in 15 minutes, and I ended up winning the contest, and French poetry contest with an English poem, and it was posted all over the prison.
Talk about defying the odds.
And that was when I realized for the first time that I could do anything. If I can do this, and that's how I survived, was a poem. And it's, you can still see it on the internet. It's on that French website, the only English thing there.
There, yeah.
But I knew I could do anything after that. I knew.
Absolutely. And what do you think has been your biggest accomplishment over the last few years? You could point at just one.
Keeping the job I got for a whole year. I go every day, and keeping a steady thing like that has never been part of my life. I've traveled since I was 18, bounced back and forth across Canada, every shelter you can think of, from Seton House in Toronto, you know, all over. I lived the streets in Montreal, and I forget what I was talking about.
So the consistency of your job is a really great accomplishment.
Yeah, and just being and wanting to go there, and not looking for that quick, like I being trusted enough to be up there has really changed who I think I am. Because there was a time when I couldn't be trusted with your dog, you know, so.
And now you get to be one of those cattle that goes to work every morning.
That's right. It's a lovely thing, isn't it?
What a fantastic to be on the other side now.
Cabbage rolls and coffee.
Fantastic. And so I think we're going to be playing another two. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No, I appreciate you having me here.
Do you have any last stories that you want to share with the world or with Canada? It's the world. I went a little far there.
No,
that's we got enough stories. Well, you can always look up Chris Kronk. It's K-R-I-S, am I right on that? And then C-R-O-N-K. So look him up and find his poem. Check it out.
All right, thanks, Lucy. So we're going to cut to a song by Dead Prez, and it's called Hip Hop. And then up next, we're going to talk to Sean, who Chris was referencing here at Megaphone. And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
One thing about music, when it hit, you feel no pain. White folks that controls your brain, I know better than that. That's game, man, we ready for that. Two soldiers head of the pack, matter of fact, who got it?
What?
And where my army at? Rather attack and not react. Back to beats, it don't reflect on how many records get sold on sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Whether your projects put on hold in the real world. These just people with ideas, they just like me and you. When the smoke and cameras disappear again, the real world. It's bigger than all these fake records. Wait, poor folks got the millions and my woman's disrespected. If you check 1, 2, my word of advice to you is just relax. Just do what you got to do. If that don't work, then kick the facts. If you a fighter, rider, bada, flame igniter, crowd exciter, or you wanna just get high, then just say it. But then if you a lie, pants on fire, wolf cry, agent with a why, I'm gon' know it when I play it. It's bigger than
hip hop. It's bigger than
shot Biggie Smalls. If we don't get them, they gon' get us all. I'm down for running up on them in they city hall. We ride for y'all, all my dogs, stay real. Don't think these record deals gon' feed your season, pay your bills, because they not. MCs get a little bit of love and think they hot. Talking about how much money they got. All y'all records sound the same. I'm sick of that fake thug R&B rap scenario all day on the radio. Same scenes in the video, monotonous material. Y'all don't hear me though. These record labels slang our tapes like dope. You could be next in line and sign and still be writing rhymes and wrote. You'd rather have a Lexus or justice, a dream or some substance, a beamer, a necklace, or freedom. Sisters like me don't play a hate, I just stay awake. It's real hip hop, and it don't stop till we get the popo off the block. They call it
hip hop. It's bigger than
to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the offices at Megaphone. You're listening to the NCRA Homelessness Marathon. My name is Madeline, and I'm here with Sean Condon, the executive director of Megaphone.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah. First of all, what does an executive director do?
What doesn't it do, I guess? Some vendors want to ask that question all the time. It's a little bit of everything. It's keeping the lights on, writing grants, asking for donations. It's working with the vendors, supporting them, working with other staff as well, and just keeping the organization moving forward.
So how did you come into this position, and what did you know about Megaphone before you got here?
Right. So I've been with the paper now for almost 10 years. And the way I got involved with Megaphone was, it's a long story, but I'll just say it literally just fell on my lap one day. But the paper had been around before that under different names. It had been known as Spare Change and Street Corner. And it's been around in Vancouver for over 20 years. And really what this is a global movement. There are over 100 street papers around the world. On any given day, there's about 14,000 vendors selling magazines and papers just like Megaphone. It's probably the biggest social enterprise in the world. And whatever the city is in, whatever the paper looks like, the model is the same. It's about empowering people who are experiencing poverty and homelessness as a way to have a voice and to earn an income.
What does the name Megaphone mean to you?
It's really that, just having a voice. It's really about trying to talk about issues here in our city that need to be told. And that is through a couple different ways. You know, that's through the writings of vendors like Chris and Peter, who've talked about their stories. We also do writing workshops here in the downtown Eastside for the community. We have journalists who do investigative stories about some social issues around housing, mental health issues, addiction issues. And then I think, you know, just in the day-to-day issues that I think Chris and Peter have touched on here about, they themselves are relaying and talking to people in their community, helping explain what homelessness is like, what their lives are like, and really about connecting people together. And I think that's really what Megaphone to me is about.
So we're broadcasting from the downtown east side, which people across Canada may have heard of, they may not have. But what is significant about this physical space that we're in right now?
Right. Well, the downtown east side is a very poor neighborhood in Vancouver. It's probably one of the poorest urban communities in Canada. It's also a neighborhood that's gone through a number of health epidemics. High rates of addiction and mental health issues are in this community. And it's also a very misunderstood neighborhood as well, where there's a lot of stigma and judgment about the people in this community. There's a large population of First Nations people here who come from communities and nations all across the country. There's also a strong sense of community here where people band together and support each other, who have often in their lives been kicked out, been told they're worthless or meaningless, and they've come here and said we're not. And we've built a community where they've created a voice for themselves. So it can be a really inspiring and beautiful community as well.
Yeah, and I know that Chris and Pete have both talked about this, about Megaphone giving people a purpose and a chance to find work that's meaningful. But from your perspective, what is the purpose of Megaphone?
Right, well, you know, I think first and foremost, it is about giving people that opportunity. You know, it's I think for a lot of people, we take for granted that we have so many opportunities and we have a lot of privilege, and there's a lot of people that just haven't necessarily been given that chance. And really, Megaphone is about fundamentally giving people that opportunity that they deserve and that we all deserve. So, you know, it's an employment program. It's for people who are experiencing poverty and homelessness. It's low barrier and low threshold. So the vendors are their own boss. They pick their own hours. They work at their spot. And that's really important, to have that kind of flexible employment, because we see that as really crucial in this community for people who have maybe addiction issues or physical health issues, mental health issues, can't necessarily do a 9-to-5. And also, you know, for some vendors that are going through different health issues, they have ups and downs, you know, this job is there for them whenever they need it. If they need to take a break, that's fine. You can come back and sell. So, you know, it's something that try to help give people some stability. But, you know, I think really it's about connecting people to different communities. The money is really important for people, especially in a really awfully expensive city like Vancouver, it's really important to have that income. But I think what we don't always think about is that poverty is really isolating, and people can feel very much on the pushed on the margins and disconnected from the rest of society. And so selling Megaphone is a great way for people to connect and make friendships, talk about some of these issues. Vendors sell the papers all throughout the city, from Carisdale to Commercial Drive. And that's, I think, really important for people to from different backgrounds to connect. And I think that's really important for the vendors, but I think it's just as important for the customers. And you can see from Peter's and Chris's stories tonight how much they mean to the customers and how much the customers look forward to seeing them and connect with them and learn from them. And so I think that's really, really essential and crucial, because we don't have necessarily so many opportunities like that. So it's really just a bridge between different people and different communities.
Yeah. You've been very generous in giving us this space to broadcast live from. And we're actually standing in what is sort of like a garage, and it's called the Vendors Hub. But there's like, you know, there are carpets on the floor and there are pictures all over the walls and lots of chairs, and we've got some coffee and cookies going. But I'm wondering, like, what does this space look like on a daily basis?
Right. Well, it is a garage that we have turned into a room, and, you know, we make do with what we can. You know, in the mornings, vendors come in, and we really try to build a place for them where they feel comfortable, where they feel that this is their space. So, you know, Peter is someone we see pretty regularly here, and other vendors, and they come in, they can grab their papers, they can sit down, they can get some coffee, they can connect with the staff, see what's going on about certain meetings or events that we're planning. And really just take a moment to start their day, but also to know that this is their space and this is their community. Vendors are talking to each other and building relationships as well. And really, I think what we try to do with Megaphone is just really make as much as we can the vendors feel that this is a good place. This is their place.
And you mentioned a term, low barrier or low threshold access to Megaphone. And that's a term that I hear people use a lot when they're talking about issues around homelessness and mental health and addictions, especially in the downtown east side. What do you mean when you're talking about that?
Right. So we have weekly training sessions for new vendors. So someone can walk in off the street. They sit down in this garage here, and after about an hour, they're signed up. They get a badge and they get their first 10 papers for free. And they can go out and they can start selling. And, you know, we just, you know, this is a job for people who identify as homeless or low income. So, you know, we don't ask for any, you know, background. It's not our business. You know, it's really just open to people, and we're not trying to judge them or where they're at or what they're doing. So, in that sense, you know, it's open to the entire community. They do have to sign a code of conduct, and there's certain rules of that, but otherwise, after that, you know, they set their own hours and they set their, you know, they work as much or as little as they like. So we have some vendors that are out there, you know, like Chris and Peter have been like 5 days a week, sometimes 6-7 days a week, and other vendors who might just be once or twice a week. And it's just a way to get a couple extra bucks and to, you know, have a place to go. So it's trying to be open and accessible, and vendors come from different spectrums as well. Some who are housed and have overcome some very difficult barriers and struggles, and others that are still going through that as well. So it's just available, and that's important, and it's non-judgmental as well.
That's fantastic. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us, and thanks for hosting.
Yeah, thanks for coming down.
Yeah, for sure. All right, I think we're going to head to a song here. This is
going to be Good for Grapes, which is a local Vancouver band with Time and Time Again. Before that, we're going to do one last land acknowledgement. Thank you so much. We are from CITR 101.9.
Listening to the annual NCRA Homelessness Marathon on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the traditional, ancestral, unceded territories of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish peoples in Vancouver.
afternoon. We're sweeping out the words that bother you. We're kind of moving on, but you're already gone. We're kind of moving on, but you're already gone. Those thoughts hang on your lips and swirl around like moving ships. I wanna scream and shout, you won't snap out of it. We're barely moving on, but you're already gone. We're barely hanging on, and you're already gone. But time and time again, we'll sing ourselves to sleep. From time to time, we'll run outside with bruises on our feet. And on again, you're coming back. And I know it hurts, but just give me something real. Just give me something real. You're more than this to me. Another fallen